No one can stop laughing, but this is the Popmatic Podcast for October 7th, 2015. Podcast where you can rock out with your library card out. I am Brian, and joining me today are
Mishael,
Jeremy,
Bill,
Amanda.
As you can hear from the echo, we're recording inside the Black Abbey Brewery. We will be recording in impromptu locations around downtown Nashville while the children's department at the main library is being remodeled.
I'm sorry I showed up late. I thought we were meeting at Gerst House.
Wait a minute. There's a reason for my madness. We snuck into this brewery to record because the Black Abbey Brewery actually used to be the Southern Library Bindery Company.
Oh.
All right. Now, the folks at Black Abbey will tell you that church ladies will still occasionally walk in with a big Bible, take it up into, like, the counter on the tap room and ask it to be rebound. I don't know if that's true.
But I hope that apocryphal story is true.
So they just pour an IPA on it and say, go to hell.
Something tells me the Black Abbey people won't say go to hell much.
But why are we recording in a brewery?
Beer!
Oktoberfest!
Because it's Oktoberfest. What is Oktoberfest?
German celebration of
October.
Yeah.
It's a German cultural festival. It has its origins in Munich, Germany, or at least the biggest one in the world happens in Munich, Germany. There's beer, there's folk songs. It actually starts, officially, the one in Munich actually starts September 19th, but it goes for a few weeks. Now, German immigrants brought this tradition over to the United States, and there are many Oktoberfests in the United States around the country, or a lot of, even if they don't call them Oktoberfests, a lot of like fall festivals or like craft fairs and things, like in many towns, large and small, in the United States.
Isn't that sort of like Cinco de Mayo, and that it's like cultural appropriation for the benefit or for the sake, for the excuse of like getting drunk?
Drink.
Yes, yeah. I would say yes. So in Nashville, where we do that, is in a neighborhood called Germantown.
Oh.
And that takes, so the Nashville Oktoberfest takes place October 9th to the 11th. That's this weekend that you're actually listening. Wait, unless you're listening asynchronously. I'm so confused. But October 9th through 11th in Germantown, Nashville Oktoberfest, it's free. There's going to be food, music, and beer. So on today's show, German stuff, bonus points if you talk about beer, penalty if you talk about fascist in boots. Anybody?
Oh, no, I think I even out then.
My breaks <All right>. Even. I would just like to point out that when I was little, I won the coloring contest in our Oktoberfest.
Wow.
Cool.
Hey, Brian, can you go first? Yeah, I can go first. Well, you never go first. Why are you going first?
I'm so confused.
Speechless I am. My jaw just dropped.
They have lots of German people there.
Brian, give me first.
Gott in Himmel.
I'm going to...
Ach du lieber.
I'm going to go first because I feel kind of frisky today.
He just wants to get his hand before everybody's asleep.
Just like...
You having Irish coffee?
Fritz-ky?
This is...
Anyone?
German coffee?
Fritz-ky?
I get it.
So another frisky person who lived on Earth was Karl Heinz Stockhausen. He was born in 1928 in Germany. He went on to become one of the most forward-thinking, innovative composers during his lifetime. That would be most of the 20th century. Electronic music especially, a lot of electronic music producers and composers look back to him. But he wrote all kinds of really bizarre music throughout his whole life. He was very prolific, over 350 like catalog pieces of music. He wrote music with just tonation. Amanda, can you tell us what that is?
What do you mean?
As opposed to like the normal Western scale of so many notes.
So it's like, so the Western scale is what's called well-tempered, so it's not a pure scale. Orchestra's tuned to A440, but sometimes, like on pianos, they'll tune the thirds closer together frequency-wise, like they're not always the same exact pitch. So I think what you're talking about is he would be C would be 260, D would be 3, whatever it is. Like, it would all, it wouldn't be relative to anything else. It would always just be singular.
Boom, exactly. Or the next note is like actually like when you can hear that it's different, as opposed to like an artificial step.
Which would sound really weird to us because we're so used to everything being related to something else pitch-wise.
Unless you're a sonic ignoramus like me and you like stuff like Stockhausen.
Well, you like noise music, so you have a different basis of relation.
Or if you're, so either two, I think this music appeals to two people. People who are sonically ignoramuses like me, and then also really, really advanced people with really advanced ears.
Who knows what he's doing and know why it's cool.
Yeah, okay. Maybe we'll talk about that later when we talk about Rammstein. spoiler! Also, chance music, location-specific music, Stockhausen was into that. So he also like made his own scores. He had a lot of like just really innovative ways to play and record the music. So he actually, his scores were kind of like art books that, you know...
They're really cool.
Yeah. So, and he won a lot of awards for the books of his scores, let alone the music itself. He was something of an egomaniac, and he claimed to be educated on the star system in Sirius.
You know, like you do.
Like you do.
Sure.
But today, I'm going to come down to earth, and I'm going to talk about one specific piece that the library has on a format called CD.
Does that mean compact disc?
I hope so. And so the title of this piece is called Stimmung, which in German means tuning, or also mood, good or bad. So it's a vocal piece for six voices, and how this is kind of composed is that there are set lyrics, but they can be sung in whatever order you want, and the rhythm isn't fixed, but each little section has a number of pitches which are fixed, so you have to hit like a certain number of pitches in each little section, but the rhythm that you sing them in and which order you apply to those, which lyrics you apply to those pitches are not. So every time you sing it, it is different, and it is tuned to adjust tonation based on a B flat. So it just kind of sounds like people like sort of humming, especially because there are a few words which the words are actually erotic poetry written by Stockhausen himself, but also like automatopoeia nonsense syllables and the names of gods. So Aboriginal gods, Aztec gods, Greek gods, and it kind of sounds like interstellar bird song. It's amazing and hypnotic and beautiful. Here's a little sample. That's just so transfixing. I love that. Or as my wife says, those are the noises I make to the cat.
Shout out to Major.
I do love this CD.
As my wife would say, can you just turn that off right now, please?
Play more Beyonce, please?
I would say that this is actually really chill. Now, if you go back, I would say that Stockhausen is really famous for his electronic music collage pieces that kind of sound like music concrete. Those sort of pieces, I think people might be like, turn that off. But this is actually really, this is a really chill CD. And this is by, the recording that we have is by a British vocal group called Song Circle. The name of the group is Sing Circle, not Song Circle. Sing Circle is such a better name. This one was recorded in 1983, and they've toured around Europe doing this version. Because it's actually, when you move on to the next section in the piece, is when there's like each piece has like a, each section has a, like a lead singer, and they decide like when the next singer in the next singer of the next piece is like in tune with them, and then they'll like visually signal, okay, now you become the lead singer, and then that like triggers the next person to sing. So it's just different every time, and even the length of the piece changes every time it's recorded, or every time it's performed. So it's actually kind of like, you could argue that it's a piece of music that you should actually see live. There should never, ever be one recording of it. But we have a lot of his other records on Frigo and Hoopla. But if you want the old-fashioned compact disc, we have Stimmung, which is an amazing record that I love a lot. Now, Mike, You're going to tell us about something. Oh, I was going to say, I know what my transition was going to be.
Oh.
So some people have criticized Stockhausen because he said he was from Sirius and his music was going to transform the world. It was revolutionary that, you know, human intelligence could be transformed to like the next level of higher being or whatever. Or like kind of like in a science fiction utopian way. And of course, how this was going to happen was by his awesome music. Which, right? But what a lot of people said was, well, if you feel that way, how come your all your pieces are so difficult and impenetrable to most people?
They really are. I mean, like, seriously.
And also, like,
hard.
Like, for instance, I don't know what key they're singing in.
They don't. There isn't one. So, I mean, they all have their own.
So, and also, your entire life, you worked within the academy, so to speak. So within the confines of, you will, of, like, really snootiest, you know, music art circles, right? So, like, if you're going to, like, transcend humanity, you really didn't reach out all that much to other people. Now, a group, I think, that maybe did reach out to a lot of people is Rammstein.
Yeah.
For better or worse.
Sehr gut, sehr gut. Willkommen, meine Damen und Herren, aus die Popmatik Podcast. I do love me a lot of things about Germany. I love their stunning variety of sausages. Oktoberfest. You know, your Hefeweizens and Dunkels. The German expressionist influences in Tim Burton's Batman, his greatest film.
Previously discussed.
Yes, yes. Don't need to go back there.
Amen.
I liked their language so much that I studied it for 3 years, even though it sounds like a choking goblin.
That's why I like it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I only remember enough to sound...
It's not a romance language.
No.
Very dramatic. Hence the name. Unfortunately, I only remember enough to sound less like a native and more like a confused kindergartner. Ugh. Anywho, since this is Mike's music year and I keep recommending music all the time, I thought I would recommend a little band called Rammstein. Founded in 1994, the group finally had its greatest success in America 4 years later with a single called Du Hast.
Well, you can't say it like that.
Du Hast.
Du Hast.
Du Hast mich. Which, you know, they translate it to you hate, even though you hate has two S's and not one S. Oh, I mean, really, it means
no
you have.
No one in America noticed.
apparently, it's all a pun on, like, what they say for wedding vows in Germany. I guess it's something to go, something to the effect of you have me and you say yes, but they say no!
Nine!
it would eventually go on the Matrix soundtrack, which, you know, was pretty amazing in 1999.
That was a good soundtrack.
Yeah, it was. Oddly enough, I can't seem to find online how exactly they crossed over to America, since most of their songs are in German.
It was like a Buzz clip on MTV, right? Like,
I guess.
Sort of maybe. Like at the nadir of Buzz Clip Nation.
I do wonder if it had to do with the video, which is like a clear reference to Reservoir Dogs, except it's from the perspective of the guy being tortured. So like, you know, they're coming at the camera and like chopping at it and stuff. Oddly enough, or no, I just said that. Nah, the Wikipedia article on Rammstein just mentions that out of the blue that they went on the Family Values tour with musical luminaries Korn and Limp Bizkit in 1998. I suddenly remembered why I stopped listening to the radio. As near as I could tell, they never topped the charts again in the United States, but continued to sell tours around the world. Their live show was supposed to be an orgy of pyrotechnics. They showed there's a picture of the lead singer, Till Lindemann, with dual flamethrowers, one in each arm, which I really want to see. And I can, because on September 25th, they released a DVD called Rammstein in America, documenting their sold-out Madison Square Garden performance in 2010. With a 2-hour-long documentary on the history of the band. Woo-hoo. I own it, but I haven't seen it yet. Someday. To me, they sounded at least like industrial metal. In fact, I got into KMFDM because I thought they sounded like Rammstein. But apparently, they're officially a Neue Deutsche Härte band, or a New German Hardness.
which makes me giggle. which apparently means more dance metal than industrial metal. Fun fact, if you go to the Neue Deutsche Härte Wikipedia page, which I advise you to do, it has way more bands for me to explore later. Oh boy, since there's something like 70 plus other bands in that genre.
I see none of which I've heard of. My panties for a year.
Yeah, that's right. Today, this week.
This week, you're a German metal band.
Oh, no. Nine. It was during the Family Values tour that the lewd singer was arrested for pouring lewd acts on stage. He says whenever the band tours the United States, now that he's on a watch list and has to be searched at airports. But other controversies that surrounded the band. In college, I was very friendly with a student from Germany in my dorm. He said the Dresdenstein used a style of German that was very popular in Nazi Germany. not to mention using...
their dialect that they sing?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And not to mention that they used Leni Riefenstahl clips in one of their videos. They're supposed to have like a very militaristic style.
She was in my book.
Oh, ooh, spoiler. Yeah. Das Spoiler.
Das Spoiler alert.
In America, the Killers from Columbine were big fans of their stuff. You could cut that. along with KMFDM. The band has been on hiatus for a few years while the members pursue side projects, although there has been some talk of releasing a new album in 2017. I'm excited.
2017?
Yeah, apparently it takes them 2 years to come up with an album. I don't know why.
It's harder to write in German.
Let's do. What do we got next? Okay.
Let's make
a
song called You Smell So Good. Like, make it say, you know, Du riechst so gut, so my best friend Matt could be embarrassed every time he sings it. I'm like, Matt, you're so lame. You know, you should sing along to High Fish, which means shark. Will I drive somewhere up north to see them live since they never come to the south? A la Motorhead. Oh, listeners. Vielleicht auch nicht. Maybe not. Und du?
Ja.
Mein Freundinnen. Sprechen Sie bitte.
Okay, so, in 1916, way back when, the German city of Berlin was scheduled to host the Olympic Games. But unfortunately, a little thing called World War I happened, which forced the Games to actually be canceled that year. So in 1939, prior to the rise of the Nazi Party, the International Olympic Committee again awarded Berlin the chance to host the Olympics. This time they scheduled it for 1936. Now, unexpectedly, you know, Hitler was named Reichschancellor of Germany, and then the Nazis solidified their political position. So, obviously, there was going to be quite a bit of controversy about whether, A, the Nazis would let Jews compete, and B, if the U.S. would participate at all. Now, America was solidly in the middle of its denial about what Hitler and his compatriots were doing inside of Germany. So, with the prompting of Avery Brundage, who was the head of the Olympic movement in the United States, we decided to compete. Our athletes headed overseas to the Games. Now, the Nazis were also forced to allow the Jews and others they considered, finger quotes, subhumans, like African Americans, they were forced to let them compete, or the IOC was going to cancel the Games again. So they're like, okay, they can come. Yeah.
Fine.
We're going to be the main day. Losers.
Das fine.
So I think the most famous member of our 1936 team is Jesse Owens. Obviously, he won 4 gold medals in track and field and sprint and long jump. He was actually the most decorated athlete at the Games, but the U.S. came in second to Germany in total medal count. We only had 56 medals. They had 89. And I'm sure that with the Nazis' inherent sense of fair play, that none of these wins were rigged in any way.
That sounds friendly. Like the Nazis.
So one of the other big stories to come out of the 1936 Games was the gold medal that was won by our 8-man rowing crew from the University of Washington. And their story is
Chronicle.
Thank you. I couldn't think. My brain stopped for a minute.
Dalton Trombone.
He's not in this.
What do you mean, Dalton Trombone?
He's not here either. So in the book, The Boys in the Boat, author Daniel James Brown catalogs, you know, the story behind this historic team.
That's a callback to the correction. It's not going to make any sense.
Future correction.
So, listeners, just keep listening.
Just keep listening. That'll
be really funny.
Save yourself 20 minutes. You'll get it.
You can get a third listener beyond, like, you know, Carrie from Perth.
Yeah, he's used to this by now. So anyway, in the 1930s, our country was in the middle of the Great Depression. Weather wasn't helping the situation. The Dust Bowl was building. So one bright spot was the actual sport of rowing in general. It was actually begun by well-to-do Brits at Eton, and rowing had long been a popular pastime, and it was actually an acceptable form of recreation for the upper classes. The University of Washington, however, was neither British nor upper class, and they had blue-collar boys that really put their heart and soul into every stroke. The story, Brown's story, follows the development of the Olympic team from Washington, and it gives us really a front row seat to not only the building of the team, but their histories of each of the eight, you know, guys in the boat. None of them really had money, and several of them actually spent summers working on the Grand Coulee Dam, hanging off the side of the mountain with a jackhammer, just so they could afford to go back to school to row each year, which I'm not sure I would have chosen to do.
Build those biceps.
I guess. They were fit enough to do it, so they got hired. And they made 25 cents more an hour than the other guys. So.
Whoa. Yeah. They could buy 10 cheeseburgers for that.
They could. So to make it to the Olympics, Washington had to beat all the powerhouse East Coast teams from the Ivy Leagues, like Princeton and Yale, not to mention the crew from Navy, which, you know, you'd think they were Navy people, they should have won. But and then once they made it to Berlin, they had a first heat, which they won easily. But then for the final, they were actually put in the out. There were six lanes. They were put in the outside lane six. And, of course, that was the lane where the wind was the fiercest and the waves were the roughest because, you know. And their coach challenged it. And, like, the Nazis came back with some weird formula that has never been since used and, like, had never been used before. Like, it's just the Nazi formula. And then Great Britain was the other big rival. They were in lane five. And then, of course, Germany drew lane one, and then the Italians were in lane two, and those were, like, perfectly smooth and sheltered and not windy, and so it helps to have home court advantage. But somehow our boys dug deep, and at the last second, and there's actually pictures of this, you can Google it on Google, that you can see the United States team is just, like, inches in front of. They actually won, beat Germany, beat Great Britain, beat Italy to win the gold medal. And I know nothing about rowing, nothing, zero. I've rowed twice and I hit a sailboat once. So.
I know it involves boats and paddles.
Yeah. But this was really interesting. And according to the book, if you crew a race at this level, it's like playing two full basketball games back to back, but condensed down into 20, like it happens in 20 minutes and there's no such thing as a timeout or a breather. Like it just attacks your body. Like you have to be in such great shape. And I'm also not gonna lie, it was pretty sweet when our guys beat the Nazis. Like Hitler didn't even Hitler was in attendance at the event, and like because rowing was so popular, and like he just like stormed off and left. Like he didn't even say anything.
Take that, Hitler.
So yeah, but my favorite other tidbit was that when the, you know, these are college guys, they're, you know, 18, 19, 20, and so they're running around, you know, Berlin in the 1930s, and so people would come up and salute them, Heil Hitler! And our boys would always salute back with, Heil Roosevelt! Like, the Germans didn't really know what to do with that, so they just would be like, okay, and then just walk away.
It's like Confucius fascist, all right?
Yeah, yeah, we like, we got you. And the 1936 Olympics was also the first time that the torch was actually run in a relay from Athens to the host city, which I thought that was interesting. Oh. So I would just like to taunt the Nazis one more time, because wait, who won the race?
Yeah, that's right.
We did. I kind of feel like it needs a Whose House Farmhouse, but I'm not really sure it's appropriate.
Whose boat?
Our boat!
Our boat!
Farmhouse!
You boat!
No, yeah. Farmhouse, y'all! Yeah.
U-boat.
So, U-boat.
U-boat.
Or your house.
That's the
Whose boat? Das Boot!
As a tangential side, did you read Dead Wake, the new Aaron Glasson book? Did you like it?
I did like it.
You know, I liked it too, but I didn't think it was as good as his other books.
No, his initial ones, his other ones are a little bit better, but it was good.
The Titanic is just a much more compelling story. Than
Devil in the White City is really good.
Yeah, that's one of his best. That one and Isaac Storm, I think, are his two best.
Totally off topic, sort of. Bill.
Mm-hmm. Bring us back, Bill.
Bring us back on topic, sort of.
Well, for Oktoberfest or German stuff.
Listen, 20 years in America, the idiocracy Oktoberfest is not going to be called the Oktoberfest anymore. It's going to be called German stuff.
Man, remember German stuff last year? Oh, man.
It'd be like German
so
stuff
weird.
And beer.
Had a pretzel thing and German stuff.
Well, I'm going to talk about a movie that on its initial release in 1968 was banned in Germany.
And this is my shocked face.
The movie I'm talking about is Mel Brooks's gloriously politically incorrect comedy, The Producers. Now, I'm strictly going to be talking about the 1968 satirical comedy, not the musical version. The movie deals with the down-on-his-luck theatrical producer Max Balingstock, played by Zero Mostel. The character, Balingstock, has resorted to becoming a gigolo to rich older women in order to financing his next play. Now, if you Zero Mostel as a gigolo is funny in itself. Enter Leo Bloom, a meek accountant played by Gene Wilder. They hatch a plan to oversell the play to investors, and when the play flops, they take the Mulan fly down to Rio. The catch is they have to find a play that will be a surefire flop. The play they choose is Springtime for Hitler.
Step one, we find the worst play in the world, a surefire flop.
Written by a former Nazi soldier and playwright, Franz Liebenkind. Now, Liebenkind, which I'm sure I pronounced wrong, is love child in German.
Yeah.
So, also, here's an interesting fact. A young actor was chosen to play this part. It was eventually played by Kenneth Mars. And the young actor had an audition to do a film in Hollywood. Mel Brooks said, oh, go ahead and do your audition for the film. Well, the young actor was Dustin Hoffman, and the film was Graduate. That's how the part went to Kenneth Mars.
Dustin Hoffman is a Nazi.
But everything does not go as planned, of course. Many critics thought the movie was in bad taste at the time of release. Legend has it Mel Brooks was riding on an elevator when a woman got on and stated she thought The Producers was vulgar, to which Mel Brooks replied, lady, it rose above below vulgarity. Today, The Producers was selected by the Library of Congress as a culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant. It even won the best Oscar for best screenplay that year. So what can I say? The Producers is better than German potato salad. German.
And it's going to be at TPAC.
That's right.
The musical version.
Mel Brooks is doing a Q&A.
Right.
During a screening of it.
The Blazing Saddles.
Oh, that's right.
Blazing
Corrections!
Yeah.
Oh, I love Blazing Saddles.
I was going to buy a ticket for it last night. If you spend something like $300, you have a chance of meeting him.
It's like $50, I think, for the cheapest seat.
Yeah, I think I may do that.
We'll just forget that.
Yeah.
I want Mel Brooks being there. That'd be cool.
I know it.
He is a cultural icon. He fought in World War II as well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like the new producers movie, like the
that
musical.
Movie's terrible.
But I do love the song "Springtime for Hitler."
I think Nathan Lane is my arch nemesis. He might be my most hated figure.
Oh, I like Nathan Lane.
In popular culture,
really.
Only because
I just broke up with you.
I'm sorry.
Oh no. This
is an audio podcast, but. The reason we can maybe post a picture of me or of Nathan Lane, but this is why.
I put a link in so we all can see Nathan Lane's signature look, which Jeremy can't stand. But when I see Nathan Lane's signature look, I think, how can you not love that face?
So you don't like a forever in face?
Every picture of Nathan Lane. Look at my range! He just has this smirk that I just want to punch him. I don't know why. Well, since I was in high school, I've seen The Birdcage, and then that's it.
I hate to derail your dilemma, but if we're going to do Tickle My Fancy, you have to go.
I'm spitting all over myself with a rage here.
Gross.
I'm sorry.
And me in the process.
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
They're spitting.
Need more German stuff.
Der Spiegel.
But I was talking about the Zero Mostel.
Yeah, you were talking about the
Mostel. Yes. Of course. The good one.
Is it my turn? It's my turn.
Why not?
You're left.
I am left. Lefties are all right. Well, guys, I noticed the topic of Oktoberfest did something that most topics don't do, and it made me think of myself.
Spit take.
Oh,
Oh, he almost snorted his coffee. Awesome.
Snarf. Snarf card. So it made me realize that I kind of roll my eyes at things a lot.
Because, like Nathan Lane.
Because if I don't...
Oktoberfest?
Yes. Because if I don't enjoy something, then other people shouldn't enjoy it either. And the truth is I don't enjoy anything. I'm working on this. Shout out to therapy. But the mention of Oktoberfest kind of turns me into a teenage Judge Judy. My problem is not with the... Because she rolls her eyes a lot, and teenagers do.
I was wondering where a teenager in Judge Judy came in.
Don't pee on my leg and tell me it's raining. Anyway.
I stopped watching after Judge Wapner left People's Court. Burp,
burp, burp. Shout out to Doug Llewellyn. My problem is not with the German people or their quaint native dress. It's just that I don't like beer much, and I prefer the privacy of my own home when I'm fall down drunk. So I don't want to be sour. But so I'm going to try to be positive.
Do you mean like sauerkraut?
Yes! Oh. Jesus Christ,
yes! He spelled it wrong.
I spelled it wrong, but I spelled it right.
Like bad puns, but that is just... Wow.
Jeremy's segment has been cut today due to lack of relevance.
Anyway, instead of...
You're on the first paragraph.
Yeah. No, the second paragraph
just started
is it. The second paragraph is it.
This is our 3-hour podcast.
I added like four things. Instead
it's
of...
It's very German. Look at
Bill's checking his clock. Because like Germans, we got to be on time. Instead of Oktoberfest specifically, I'm going to think about fall festivals and leaves on the ground and decorative gourds and non-Tennessee football shades of orange. And this burst of autumnal sunshine has made me think of Norman Partridge's brief but gripping novel, Dark Harvest. Every Halloween, a mythical creature rises from a cornfield in a small Midwestern town. He goes
it's
by a
great
number
pumpkin.
Of that's right. He goes by
watch out, Charlie Brown.
He goes by a number of names: Old Hacksaw Face, Sawtooth Jack, and the October Boy. This is
watch out, it's the October Boy.
Run,
oh no!
He has leader husband.
Wow!
Somebody wow. Give him an accordion.
Everybody take a shizen on me. Do a shizen off.
Is it the April Kid? No, it's the October Boy.
Christ on a crutch.
So scary.
Anyway.
The fear.
This pumpkin-headed scarecrow beast races through the streets of town where teenage boys all sort of vie for a chance to hunt this October boy and kill him. And this is a rite of passage that earns the winner a chance at a better life. On October 31st, 1963, young Pete McCormick resolves to be the one to catch the October boy and carve him up good. And instead of getting a pillowcase full of candy, Pete faces off against the mean old town sheriff, his layabout father, and the awful secret at the core of this strange ritual. Now, this book has a really fantastic opening. It's the kind that, like, when you read it, you just want to keep reading, which is, I guess, what the opening of a book is supposed to do. I will now read it for you. It's three sentences, but they're all very short sentences. A Midwestern town. You know its name. You were born there. And maybe you guys think that's lame, too, like October Boy, but by God, there's
a... Not the most gripping, but okay. Well,
anyone who wasn't born in the Midwest just took that book and threw it on their couch.
No.
Guess what? Most of the country is the Midwest, you East Coast snob.
Well, I'm sure this Tennessee Library podcast will have lots of Midwesterners tuning in.
Hey, man,
that's not what the Electoral College says.
Y'all just keep on going now.
I like how I get the credit for derailing the podcast.
I'm hanging out in Los Angeles with all my Carl Heinz Stockhausen listening buddies.
Welcome to Berlin. I'm hanging out with my German friends on Oktoberfest.
Yeah.
Anyway, there's a familiarity. There is a familiarity in this sentence, which is sort of like is familiarity that's in the best scary stuff. It's like a thing that you know, even if you're not from the Midwest. There is an idea that is there that you know that sort of, it's the kind of like jumping at your shadow.
That's why genre fiction sucks.
Pardon me, would you have any gray poupon?
I didn't even say stuff, but he just flared it like a Like
this sounds like Something Wicked This Way Comes, which both the book and the movie put me to sleep, but okay.
Good Lord, in heaven. If you take away the hustle bustle and all arts and culture in a town, and folks will quickly get up to no good. Unfortunately, the secrets that most small towns keep are reserved to garden variety perverts and a thriving pill-popping culture and not murderous blood rites, which make the coolest holiday seem even cooler. This is the only book that I've read by Norman Partridge, and unfortunately it's the only book of his that we have in our collection, but it's definitely worth your time. I just put in a request for another book of his through ILL. Make fun of that too. And it just...
ILL's awesome.
What's it called?
It's called The Man with the Barbed Wire Fist.
That's kind of cool.
Okay! Under 200 pages, this book will not take up much of your time. Dark Harvest, yes, Dark Harvest won the 2006 Bram Stoker Award and was on Publisher Weekly's list of the 100 best books of 2006. That may sound like stats used to fill time because I'm running a little short here, but they reminded me of a time when I was a kid and I found a dead duck in a cemetery. See, that joke doesn't work because I was going to do that anyway. So if you're like me and you're ready to start the fall season off with a bit of short and sweet dark horror instead of rancid Bavarian meats and ales, check out Dark Harvest.
Bill! Hey, wait, what's the...
Hey, guys.
Hey, guys.
What do we do?
Want to tickle my fancy.
Well...
We creep our listeners out.
Maybe the library has it. Maybe the library doesn't, but either way, it's tickling our fancy, Bill.
Tickling My Fancy is a documentary called Smiling Through the Apocalypse, Esquire in the 60s. It's about Harold T.P. Hayes, who was a visionary editor who brought unique writers, photographers, artists together to create one-of-a-kind magazine. The documentary was written, produced, edited, directed by his son, Tom Hayes. It takes you to a time of Muhammad Ali, Lieutenant Kelly, Gore Vidal, William F. Buckley, and Frank Sinatra has a cold. I highly recommend this documentary.
Editor's note? Great segue. No, really.
I really like the new ELO song, When I Was a Boy, even if it is a ballad and sounds like an outtake from New World Record.
Soon as I was in my bed, music played inside my head. When I was a boy, I had a dream. When I was a boy, I learned to play. Far into the night and drift away. Don't want to work on the milk or the bread.
There's a new record, ELO record, coming out November 13th called Alone in the Universe, the band's first since 2001. It's being released under the name Jeff Lynne's ELO, which I'm assuming is to avoid confusion with Electric Light Orchestra 2, which is just ELO without Jeff Lynne, which is sort of like Creedence Clearwater Revisited, which is just CCR minus John Fogerty, which is not worth your time.
What's tickling your fancy, Amanda?
So this past weekend, I was in Florida, and my mother-in-law and I decided to go see a movie, and the latest Nancy Meyers movie, The Intern, had just come out, and I love Nancy Meyers. I think I've actually talked about her on the podcast before. So I really, really wanted to see it. Plus, if I went with my mother-in-law, my husband wouldn't whine about having to see a chick flick.
Okay, Benjamin, I'm going to ask you one of our more telling questions for all of our interns, so I want you to, like, this is the one to really think about, okay? Where do you see yourself in 10 years?
When I'm 80.
And I love myself. The world is a ghetto.
Remember a few weeks ago we talked about the senior intern program?
Seniors in high school or college?
No. Seniors in life.
Hold on. What?
That's our founder and CEO, Jules Austin.
Any tips before I go in?
Blink.
Blink.
She hates when people don't blink. It weirds her out.
Hi, Jules. I'm Ben, your new intern.
I'm glad you also see the humor in this.
Be hard not to.
I will email you when I have something for you to do.
I'll wait to hear from you, sir. I'm terribly sorry. Excuse me.
So you're Jules' new driver?
No, actually, I'm her intern.
That's hysterical.
My internship keeps busy.
Mr. Congeniality. Everybody loves him.
You should dress to impress. Tuck in the shirt. Why doesn't anybody tuck anything in anymore? Oh, I'm asking you.
I'm Fiona, the house masseuse.
Ben.
How's that been?
Well, oh boy.
Here you go.
You're not as old as I thought you were.
So you're on Facebook, huh?
I joined about 10 minutes ago.
Well, better late than never.
All right, so there are all these questions for your profile that you can answer if you want to, like people who inspire you.
Jules Austin. You do inspire Jules.
Our investors just think that a seasoned CEO could take some things off your plate.
I mean, give me CEO lessons.
I never had anything like this in my life. This big, beautiful, exciting thing that you created.
Remember who did that?
Who?
Good times.
It's moments like this when you need someone you know you can count on. Because you're my...
intern.
Well, I was gonna say intern / best friend.
Look and learn, boys, because this is what cool is. How in one generation have men gone from guys like Jack Nicholson and Harrison Ford to...
Oh, boy.
So the basic premise is 70-year-old Ben Whitaker, a.k.a. Robert De Niro, applies for a senior internship with Anne Hathaway's internet startup, which is kind of like a clash of, you know, generations. De Niro is really classy, and he's really old school. Like, he takes his briefcase and his calculator and his pens and his glasses, and like the other guys have their iPad and their, you know, jump drives and all of that. But you really like him immediately, and you root for him. And he actually teaches all the boys working for the company how to be real men. And he becomes so much more than just an intern. I laughed, I cried, even my mother-in-law had a good time. And it was definitely a really good addition to the Nancy Meyers pantheon. Mac?
Well, welcome, listeners, to the first podcast in Chartobo.
I'm not scared yet.
You should be.
We did have a dark harvest.
We did,
yes,
that's true.
We did.
Scary October boy painful.
October boy.
Oh, October boy. Run for the hills. Oh, no, it's November girl. Be sure it was turkey, you know. Today I thought I'd talk about a trio of horror novels that are coming out in October. They're all from Penguin Classics. You know, it sounds like fun. You know, I haven't read them, and I'm courting danger by wrenching three instead of two.
Because we're running out of time.
Yeah, I know. Okay, number one, Perchance to Dream by Charles Beaumont. Charles Beaumont wrote 22 Twilight Zone episodes, being like the most of any other writer than Rod Serling, who wrote like 120 or something. I always liked his stories, so it'd be kind of neat to like have a whole collection of them. Most notably, The Howling Man, about a hiker in Europe in the 30s, I believe, who like goes into like this abbey, and like there's this guy locked up, and the guy's like, you know, these monks, they locked me up and they wanted me to go help me out, and it turns out the guy's got his dark secret. Book number two, Songs of a Dead Dreamer and Grimmscribe by Thomas Lee Goethe, I believe. This guy's apparently like a big deal in a cosmic horror field, and like this is a combination. His first two collections combined into one volume. apparently he's influenced by the strange terrors of Lovecraft and Poe and the brutal absurdity of Kafka, as says the back of the book. He eschews cheap, gory thrills for his own brand of horror, which shocks at the deepest existential levels.
That guy's amazing.
Oh, cool.
You will want to take a shower.
Oh boy. Yeah. I'm excited.
I'm just going to take a shower and not do that.
Yeah, dirtiness from the day and not from horror.
That's right, just because my hair is dirty.
And book the third, The Case Against Satan by Ray Russell. Basically, it's like The Exorcist, but it was written 10 years before. It's about these two priests who exorcise a demon from a young girl, but it turns out the demon may be more than just your garden variety demon. It may be the devil himself. People who have read the book say that it's better than The Exorcist, which, you know, I hope so, because although The Exorcist is overrated snob cardo. Mary Russell was best known, at least for me, as the writer of X, The Man with X-Ray Eyes, starring Ray Milland, which is Roger Gordon's best film. I like it unironically. It's actually really good. So I'm hoping that this book is good.
Correct! corrections!
I believe Mike and I both have corrections, but I would like to yield the floor to the good man from Georgia.
Oh, I thank you, the good man from Kentucky. First of all, Sherry Belafonte was one of the main characters in another Canadian paranormal show called Beyond Reality, which was often paired with Friday the 13th, the series, in the early days of the Sci-Fi Channel. Whoops. I enjoyed watching reruns. It was good. Varum is German for why. Voss is German for what. If you caught that, good for you.
Ugly American.
Here's a golden oldie from way back in August. I mentioned that Garrett Hedlund had tweeted about Deadwood. It's really Garrett Dillahunt. I got my Garretts crossed.
Delayed correction.
I was embarrassed because I found out recently that Garrett Hedlund played the main character of Tron 2, and he's been tweeting that there may be a Tron 3. Blasphemous confession, I actually like Tron 2 better than Tron.
That's like the assembled nerddom, like crying out
yeah,
in agony.
That's right. I'd rather take Daft Punk than, you know. I'm not going to say like either of them are great, but you know.
Tron 1 is great.
No. Not even David Warner could say that. And remember when I said a long, long time ago that we had the first Lone Wolf and Cub omnibus and we didn't? Well, it turns out we do now. Yeah.
Ta-da!
I think I saw that recently.
The nice people in Collection Development had actually did listen to me, but they didn't reply to my email. So enjoy, listeners. What do you got, Jeremy?
Well, I wanted to say that Neil Bush did not go to jail.
One of them did.
What a loss to the arts.
Neil Bush did not go to jail. He was a member of the board of directors of the Silverado Savings and Loan, whose collapse cost taxpayers $1.3 billion during the SNL crisis in the 1980s. There was a government investigation that found that Bush was guilty of breaches of his fiduciary duties involving multiple conflicts of interest, but he was not indicted on criminal charges. He did, however, settle out of court a class action suit against himself and the other board of directors, which cost him about $50,000. So I was totally wrong to besmirch his good name. Also, I wanted to point out that it was really funny how Bill and I weren't here for the end of Tickle My Fancy segment, but we made it back in time for corrections. I thought that was
amusing.
Pretty cool.
Magical.
Listening to it. Well, you know, you guys stepped out for a minute and then came back.
Yeah, we had to go out.
Listeners, we record the corrections first. That's what it's often callbacks.
Oh.
That you never get.
Strange callbacks to something that, you know, doesn't happen.
I just wanted to pull the curtain back a little bit. I don't know. I was listening to it and I was like, oh, that,
I don't know.
That might be confusing to someone.
You are sucking me down this rabbit hole, but...
I like that you blame me for your rabbit hole suckage.
Well,
you are just
in regards to presidential siblings. Roger Clinton was arrested for cocaine possession, but his brother pardoned him and expunged his criminal record before he left office.
Oh, that was one of those like last days.
Yeah,
things.
That was like, yeah, hey, no one noticed this.
Yeah, wink, wink. Oh,
like you owe me.
Yeah, he sort of made a like an art out of pardoning people.
Moving on, before I start making corrections for like the last four episodes.
Corrections.
Okay, corrections. The literature song by Moxie Fruvis is actually called "My Baby Loves a Bunch of Authors."
Oh.
And it's funny because you can tell they're Canadian because there's like a really like academic list of authors.
Yeah, one of them.
Can we also make a note that noted sexual predator Gian Gomez
did
Moxie Fruvis?
Yes, when we walked around downstairs, I was like, this is the lead singer did something really bad. Oh yeah, he did something really bad.
He was the host of a Canadian radio show called Q that was on public radio.
That guy.
Gian
Gomeshi.
To get back on track, you can hear the sex criminal sing "My Baby Loves a Bunch of Authors" and King of Spain on the album Bargainville.
Only one was a sex criminal. The others are okay.
Speaking of maybe cringeworthy things, Mike made a passing reference to the band Viet Cong. They actually changed their name.
Oh, they did?
Yes.
Oh, which I'm glad they did. It's kind of shocking.
Which they said they would never do, but they did. And now at the time of writing, they are nameless. You also made a passing reference to a novel called The Mote in God's Eye. This is a 70s sci-fi classic by Larry Niven and Jerry Purnell.
It's wonderful.
Put that out there.
On the gripping hand, it's also amazing.
Its influence looms large over science fiction. Oh, this is the sensitive one. I will leave it up to listeners to decide if Bill consistently said trombo or trombone when talking about screenwriter Dalton Trombo. I will let listeners decide for themselves what Bill said.
I got into a groove there, man.
I think you were like doing one, like you were alternating. I think you were not saying trombone.
Well, I wanted to cover my bases.
I think it sounded like
every inflection, one of them has to be right.
One of them has to be right. So.
And I had one other thing that I was kind of like sensitive about because I think the way that I said it made me sound dumb, but I'm just going to skip it because we're running out of time. For more information about Brian sounding dumb and Dalton Trombo and probably Canadian sex criminals, right? Probably. You can go to www.library.nashville.org. And our theme music is by
Adam Dean.
Next week.
Ooh. Sharktober Nights. Paradise.
Sharktober. Sort of held up as a symbol of innocence. But anyone who's from a small town or isn't from a small town knows that the only thing innocent in a small town is Snoop Dogg performing Murder Was the Case on the local radio station in 1994. Fun fact.
You went all the way for Snoop Dogg?
Wow. Man. You derailed yourself.
That's why I'm so angry. I was derailing myself for the sake of you all.
We
and then you
have
derailed me. Fun fact, Perth is the capital and largest city in the state. I'm not even going to say that. So if you take away.
That's still not the end.
Wow.
I'll be leaving now.
I have to say that
we'll see you in the corrections.
It was very fun, your segment. Didn't, you know. Your book may be good.
Thanks.
I'm not going to read it.
I could read it. It may be better to read it than... that whole, like, Midwestern good home value, you know, that kind of Stephen King kind of crap.
I'll read Hug and Dreams by Tom Groy.
Patron saint of this podcast, quote Mike Jones 2 weeks ago.
Hey, you wrote Creepshow, so he's got this, like...
That's right, he has the Stephen King card.
Yeah.
I try to keep my business together.
Yeah.
Throw me under the bus and spit on me.